Okay, my friends, now it's time for us to start. So last time, there was some confusion about one rule, how to formulate Feynman diagrammatic technique. And I decided to write down once again the action that describes interacting fermions with a repulsive interaction U of Q. So the point is, even if you assume that this potential U of Q does not depend on frequency, and in fact it does not depend, you should imply, better to say, that it carries some bosonic Matsubara frequency. In other words, if you have a vertex and this is dashed line, minus U of Q is a dashed line, then if you have fermionic Green's function here that carries frequency omega n by momentum k, spin sigma, then you assume that your potential carries momentum q that stands here and some bosonic Matsubara frequency omega m. And this Green's function will have frequency omega n plus omega m, comma k plus q, and spin sigma. Omega n is fermionic Matsubara frequency. It is equal to 2 pi times n plus 1 half t. And omega m is bosonic, equal to 2 pi m t. Things are completely consistent here. So omega n has half integers. And here, omega n plus omega m has half integers as well. So there is absolutely no inconsistency, because if you add an integer to half integer, you will still get half integer. So we can write down explicitly the rule. And this is what you should write down and indicate that this rule substitutes the one that I gave you during the previous lecture. So, and it reads as follows. Rule one, the first rule. The sum over all frequencies bosonic and fermionic omega I and momenta pi emanating from an interaction vertex formed by one dashed line and two solid lines. So dashed line is interaction and solid line is fermion propagator. Lines is zero, exactly as indicated in this figure. Any questions? So now we can straightforwardly write down the expressions for Hartree and Fork self-energy. So this is the diagram that determines Hartree self-energy. So here we have omega n k sigma, omega n k sigma, omega n are fermionic Matsubara frequencies. Here q is equal to zero, and bosonic frequency corresponding here is equal to zero. And here we must sum over the internal momentum p sum over other frequency fermionic Matsubara frequency omega 1 and sum over say spin alpha. And this gives us u of naught t over v sum over omega 1 p alpha g naught omega 1 p, right? And this gives us n u of 0. So it is important that we take into account here also the sum over spin. N is the number of particles divided by volume, namely concentration. 1 minus sign comes from the dashed line, and 1 minus sign comes from fermion loop. This is Hartree. And Fock diagram, Fock, is given by this. Omega n k sigma. Here we write momentum q and some bosonic Matsubara frequency omega m. That's why here for the internal line we must write omega n plus omega m comma k plus q, the same sigma. And here we have omega n k sigma. So the self energy is given by this construction, and this is self energy, say, Hartree. So the self energy, that is Fock self energy, is given by the following: minus T over V, sum over formally omega M, that is bosonic, comma, sum over Q, U of Q, G naught, omega N plus omega m comma k plus q. So we formally sum here over bosonic frequencies, but look at this expression. We have the sum of bosonic frequency and fixed fermionic frequency. So effectively, we still sum over fermionic Matsubara frequencies. We make a shift, and if we carefully look at the type of frequencies we are going to make a sum over, then we see that this frequency is a sum of fermionic and bosonic, and effectively this is fermionic Matsubara frequency. Let's denote it as omega 1. And effectively we can just write that this expression is equal to nothing else than minus T over V, sum over sum fermionic Matsubara frequency omega 1 comma Q, U of Q, G naught of omega 1 comma K plus Q. So if U of Q does not depend on Q, we can take this out of the sum over momenta, shift this momenta, and get that in complete analogy with what stands here, that this is equal to minus n u of 0 divided by 2.
Like here, originally the sum was like the sum over omega n. Like
yes, how, originally.
Yeah, how can we like just substitute omega n plus omega n to sum over omega n?
Yeah, we can, because omega n contains half integers, omega m contains integer. If you add integers to half integers, you will still get the sequence of half integers of fermionic Matsubara frequencies. And we can make this substitution. We can call this sum as omega 1 that runs over half integers, and assume, or label better to say, that we have the sum over fermionic Matsubara frequencies. Mm-hmm.
Why is there sum equal to n?
This?
Yeah.
So this is for point-like interactions. So for point-like interactions,
so
U of q does
it. This
is what I explained two lectures ago. Yeah, two lectures ago when I derived the relation between total numbers of particles and Green's functions. Yeah.
How can you just have a sum over just omega 1 in the last sentence?
Yes. Amazing. Because omega 1 is the sum of bosonic Matsubara frequency and fermionic Matsubara. So if we make an effective shift, if we just simply look at our expression, then we effectively have sum over half integer frequency from minus infinity to infinity.
So like in this case, because we are considering like interactions between same spins, but if the interaction doesn't depend on the spin, then there'll be no, the two corrections will be canceled.
If interaction does not, well, in our case, interaction, so if, or that's a good question. If interaction does not depend on spin, so in this case, we assumed that our interaction had the form. So U of Q equal, so U, I believe, alpha beta was just U of Q. So it is independent of spins.
Then why do we have the factor of 1/2? Because it seems like the factor of 1/2 comes from the fact that they have to be the same spin in the interaction.
This is for the interaction that does not carry any spin indices. So that's why we have this diagram. So spin is unchanged. So at the vertex. Otherwise, in general, of course, the dependence of spin will matter. But and in this case, Green's functions will have spin indices, and the diagram technique will be more complicated. But so here, we already took into account, if you look at the form of our interaction, that you still can imagine that U of Q carries some spin indices, like in this form. So already those things are taken into account.
Yeah. Perhaps we can interpret the action as the interaction between one with an activity freedom with four fermions.
We can interpret this as interaction of particles independent of spins in this form. Well, concerning bosonic degrees of freedom and fermionic degrees of freedom, I'm not sure. Okay, let me just continue.
Well, U of Q is like scalar potential.
Okay, let's talk later about this subtle issue. Okay, I hope things are now clear. Just to remember, just rewrite this rule and remember it. So this is what happens at first order in interactions. Now let's move forward and ask ourselves what happens if we take into account interactions at the next order. So I should tell you that the number of diagrams that will ensue is quite large. Is larger because you can add to these Hartree and Fock contributions. So, and their computation is considerably more involved. But things are still not that bad. So let me write down the diagrams that will contribute to self-energy at the second order in perturbation. There are six diagrams, and I will break them in three classes. So first diagrams that will contribute to, I will call 2A. These are as follows. one loop and another loop on top of this loop. Good. Diagram of this kind. There are two diagrams. Right. Okay, this one. Loop here. And it is here. Plus. So I don't want to waste time writing those momentous frequencies, spin indices, but I will do this only for one diagram. So and to see, that looks like this. So one is this one. Plus, and what I do here, I will write it like this, and write the frequencies and momenta, omega n, k, sigma, here, here. This dashed line carries bosonic Matsubara frequency and momentum q. Here we have omega n plus omega m, k plus q sigma. Here we have omega n, k, sigma. This must necessarily go up and also carry the same value of momentum q and omega m. And what we have here the following. This internal line entering this loop has momentum p. Matsubara frequency, I will call it omega l, some spin index alpha, and this line. And what is on top give us p minus q, comma omega L minus omega m, comma, index alpha. So we integrate over p, sum over internal omega l, and sum over spin alpha. So omega l n, comma, omega l fermionic. I'm writing different chapter with confusion here. So here, omega l. L omega m, sorry, omega L omega n fermionic. Omega m bosonic. Here. Well, I decided simply to give an example how frequency, momentum, and spin indices should enter diagrams. So what we effectively have here? We have here one more bubble or one more loop, a loop in which we sum over p and omega l and sum over all spins. So it will be effectively this object. And this is called fermionic loop, a function of still bosonic frequency omega m. And then we take into account this fermionic line and have to sum over bosonic frequency omega m to get the effective contribution to second order self energy as a function of omega n and k. So there are six diagrams, and it looks like the computation requires a lot of effort. That's true. But let's look at this class of diagrams. What do we have here? We have here the effective corrections to the Green's function entering this loop, Do you see this? Here and here. So this dashed line corrects in a fork way this internal Green's function. And this bubble on top corrects Green functions entering this loop as an effective Hartree correction. This means that these two diagrams belong to the so-called Hartree class of skeleton diagrams. Well, I don't know how the word skeleton is common, but I believe that this is what I saw in the literature. Skeleton diagrams in which this Green's function entering the loop is effectively substituted by exact Green's function. And no matter how many corrections we include to this internal loop, it will effectively contribute to exact calculation of the Green's function. So even if we imagine that we have here exact Green's function and here substitute this bare Green's function with the exact one, we still get that this diagram with exact Green's function included gives us n times u naught. Because this relation n over v equal to t, or actually, yeah, n over v equal to t sum over omega n sum over p g omega n comma p and sum over spins, say, this relation holds for any Green's function. Even if we have the Green's function that is exact. So we can safely write that these diagrams do not require any calculations. They are already included in this Hartree skeleton diagram. And we must simply ascribe this simple result, that four-point-like interaction that doesn't depend on momentum, it is equal to n of u naught. Yes?
For the Hartree skeleton,
why
do we need u to equal u zero?
We don't need. We don't need. And for the fork, we need, yes. Yeah, that's very important. So that's an excellent comment. So yes, for Hartree, we can have interaction that depends of Q. And for fork, so this is for point like only. Now, let's look at these two diagrams. What do we observe here? We observe the corrections to this internal line and this correction here is of the Hartree type, and the correction also to the internal line that is fork type. And we see that these two diagrams can be effectively represented, included, better to say, in the fork skeleton diagram in which this internal line is substituted by exact Green's function. For point-like interaction in which u of q does not depend on q, this skeleton diagram also does not need a separate calculation. It is equal to minus u of naught divided by 2, like for the case with bare diagrams. So we have to acknowledge that these two diagrams are already taken care of by this fork skeleton diagram. Any questions? Yeah?
So we always say the outermost diagram determines whether it's Hartree or fork type. Like, I mean, for example, the 2B you say is, or I'll contain it, the fork skeleton. So you just say that the outermost one looks like a fork, and whatever's in the inside is just some correction.
Exactly. Exactly. You, for example, can have whatever you want here. You can have, say, this, then
whatever.
Everything is included. Everything is included. So in this case, what these two just contributions just will renormalize chemical potential. And because chemical potential must be itself determined self-consistently at the very end, then these are non-essential diagrams that won't add any new physics. Okay. Any other questions? Because this moment is very interesting. This is illustrates how amazing the method of the diagrammatic technique is, because you can sum diagrams in blocks and anticipate what the final result is going to be. So what we are left with these two diagrams. These two diagrams. So these diagrams require separate calculations, and their computation is quite involved, especially at finite temperature. So for the diagram is simple. You can probably spend a couple of days computing this diagram. Yeah. So to compute this diagram, more work is required. You can easily spend just 3-4 days. Nevertheless, people computed this long time ago. They computed this in late 50s. So there is a famous paper by Kerzon Huang and Chen-Ning Yang who initiated this type of research. This is the famous paper of 1957. And of course, I'm not going to calculate it, but I'm simply telling you that these two are the only diagrams that require separate calculation. So to calculate those at zero temperature is simpler, but at finite temperature, this requires a lot of work. That's true. And what I will do, I will state only the results. And the results are as follows. So self-energy up to second order can be written in this form. I will write self-energy 1, 2 is equal to n u of naught divided by 2 plus contribution from diagrams to C. This is just formally. And we know that we calculate those diagrams to determine the excitation spectrum and the, better to say, quasi-particle spectrum. So if you subtract the value of the chemical potential, then you will get excitation spectrum. So the equation that determines quasi-particle spectrum looks like this. Epsilon k minus mu equal to k squared divided by 2m minus mu minus n u naught over 2 minus sigma to c. And here you substitute epsilon k minus mu comma k. This is the equation that corresponds to the pole of the Green's function calculated up to second order in interaction. So you see that you may cancel these chemical potentials. And so in this term, you can, instead of epsilon k, substitute, say, k squared divided by 2m. This is a legitimate approximation. And that this will be your equation. That this will be your equation that determines quasi-particle spectrum. So this expression is extremely complicated if you compute it, even at zero temperature. So there is absolutely no reason to write this down. But what is essential essential is the following. Even at zero temperature, calculation of this portion will give you imaginary part for epsilon k. So the result is epsilon k equal to, I would say, mu plus at zero temperature kf divided by some m star times k minus kf if, plus I times some number a kf alpha squared k minus kf squared divided by m. For momenta that lie close to Fermi surface, for k minus kf much smaller than kf. So the most interesting region of our k space is what's going on near Fermi surface. So if this is kf, then this is the region near Fermi surface. And this is the region where quasi-particles have those energy. So this is the real part. And it depends linearly on the distance to kf. That's probably what one should expect. But this m star is the so-called, I will split the next question. This m star is given by the following. M star equal to m times this bracket 1 plus some parameter b. This is just a number, numerical number, kf alpha squared. The question is, what is alpha? So this is called effective mass. Effective mass. Effective mass of quasi-particles. Because this formula resembles the same dispersion law as we observe for the case of free particles, only with renormalized mass. Then what is alpha? So what is alpha? Alpha is the following parameter. Alpha is equal to m u of naught divided by 4 pi. And I will insert here Planck's constant. I neglected so far Planck's constant, but I will insert here. So this is called scattering length. Scattering length. It has the dimension of length. And it describes, it's basically the parameter that determines a scattering cross section. If you imagine two quantum mechanical particles that scatter interacting with this potential, then cross section sigma will be equal to 4 pi alpha squared. So this is scattering cross section. Scattering cross section. You see that the small parameter is very particular. It's not, say, u divided by Fermi energy, as one would expect. But this parameter, kf, that has the dimension of inverse length, times alpha, that has the dimension of length. This is what perturbation theory shows. So physically, this is because the quantum mechanical observable is not interaction between atoms or electron itself. But observable is this parameter, scattering cross-section. When people study scattering of relativistic and non-relativistic particles with respect to each other, they measure this. That's really remarkable, because this is what calculations show. calculation show. So small parameter is not the strength of interaction between electrons or atoms divided by Fermi energy, but this parameter, Kf alpha. And we say that Kf alpha is a real small parameter. Is a real small parameter. So what do we see here? We see that mass is renormalized. But we see something else. We see imaginary part for quasiparticle spectrum. This means that quasiparticles are not stable, contrary to real particles. Real particles are real particles. Free particles. Free particles don't interact with each other and act completely independently. But interacting particles, they interact with each other, and their spectrum is a result of collective motion. So it is natural to see that they have finite lifetime. However, this imaginary part is small when k is close to kf. This means that here, just very close to Fermi surface, quasiparticles can be interpreted simply as long-lived particles. And we can use this spectrum to calculate thermodynamic quantities, neglecting the imaginary part. Yeah.
What does the imaginary part mean?
Mean in inverse lifetime. So if imaginary part is small, then lifetime is large.
How is it related? I mean, inverse lifetime and imaginary.
Follows from Heisenberg uncertainty relations, involving time. If you write the uncertainty in energy, and so uncertainty of time in time. So this uncertainty in time will correspond to lifetime of a particle. This is what textbooks in quantum mechanics say. So when k minus kf is small, then particles along their lifetime is large. So they can be considered nearly stable. So, but even if you assume that this parameter is not small, so kf alpha is of the order of 1. We're assuming that it is small. We construct perturbation series assuming that this parameter is small. But if you notice that even if it is not small, it is just of the order of 1, then the closeness to Fermi momentum still means that quasiparticles near Fermi momentum, quasiparticles whose energy lie closer to chemical potential, they still have large lifetime, even if Kf alpha is not small.
How can we see that there's what kind of Fermi diagram generates this imaginary
these two?
How can we see, is there any apparent way to see that it will contribute to an imaginary?
Yes. So the way is, let's look at that bubble. This is the bubble that has analytical reading, the expression via Green's functions, the one you saw during yesterday's tutorial, right? This is, in fact, kappa d. If you remember the first question from yesterday's tutorial, then you are asked to do Matsubara summation in susceptibilities. And you saw two susceptibilities. So chi c, I believe, and chi d. So the susceptibility chi d is nothing else than this bubble that enters this diagram. So if you compute, and you received after summing over fermionic Matsubara frequencies some kind of the function that is a function of I omega m that is bosonic. bosonic. So if you do analytical continuation as follows, I omega m going to omega plus some infinitesimal imaginary part, then this infinitesimal imaginary part will indeed give you something imaginary as a result of analytical continuation. And this will contribute to finite lifetime. So basically, what you have, this difference of energies. I believe this. So if we substitute, I don't remember whether it was plus or minus, or minus, probably it was minus. So if we substitute this, we are going to have omega minus I naught. And when we integrate over momenta p, we must take this explicitly into account. And you using the famous formula that, the integral of something of x minus I naught is equal to the integral that contains, principal value, something x minus I plus I pi delta x minus A. So this will give imaginary part. And when you integrate over moment P, and this will be the remaining integration, then you will automatically get imaginary part in this diagram. So this is just to give you some flavor where it comes from. So yeah, we're not going to take care of this. This is way too complicated for us. Good, yes.
Can you explain again why the imaginary part come to become the lifetime of the quasar?
Well, I don't know how many textbooks consider those issues in detail. So, but imagine the scattering, say of one particle with over some other particle, and the original particle interacts with the other particle via some potential. Then it's a good question. How to explain? Then you can consider solving Schrödinger equation. It's a two particle problem, and it will give you some spectrum, some spectrum. So your two particle system will have some energy spectrum, and when you solve this Schrödinger equation and try to determine the energy of the particle after scattering, then it may contain imaginary part. So, but this is a purely quantum mechanical problem. So here, this is interpreted as a lifetime because energy changes. Energy as a result of interactions, energies change, and there is just an uncertainty relation that delta E times delta T is of the order of H. So if energy changes, then this is interpreted as a lifetime of the particle. But it's a quantum mechanical issue. I'm not so I can't think of any better explanation. But your question makes me very, very good sense how the imaginary part in the diagrams appear. So remember, we have to do analytical continuation. We have to do analytical continuation, not simply saying that omega m goes to minus I omega, but we must add some infinitesimal. Some infinitesimal, this is how, yeah, things work.
If you prepare the system with one quasi-particle, say, so it's an interesting eigenstate of one quasi-particle, and then you wait, you let the time, the system evolve for many lifetimes of the quasi-particle, what happens after several lifetimes have passed? What does the system look like? Does it like splits into more quasi-particles or what?
So there is such a thing as a quasi-particle decay. It exists, but in this picture, as a result of interaction, when many quasi-particles, when many lifetimes have passed, then simply the energy of these quasi-particles is redistributed among the other quasi-particles. And since we have very many particles, we still have a certain number of particles that will have the energy close to the original ones.
Can you think of that as the initial quasi-particle decaying into many quasi-particles?
It scatters of many quasi-particles. Well, it can decay. In the case of fermions, it scatters. It scatters, so giving its energy to other quasi-particles. But other quasi-particles simultaneously give the energy to other quasi-particles, and so forth. When we have bosons, when we have interacting bosons, there we must also study the process of decay. So when one bosonic quasi-particle decays into many. But for fermionic quasi-particles, I will tell next about Landau concept, about Landau Fermi liquid. But when we have a finite number of fermionic quasi-particles, then their interaction reduces to the process of scattering. So the energy of quasi-particles undergoes constant, of all quasi-particles, they undergo constant redistribution as a result of interactions. So let me just continue. So, at zero. At zero, because if you have finite temperatures, you will have further corrections proportional to T squared. To T squared. So, temperature also leads to finite lifetime, right? Yeah. But there will be another contribution. So, this is so at zero temperature. Very good. At T going to zero. So let me continue. This result, along with experimental data on helium-3, led famous Soviet theorist Lev Landau to postulate his theory of Landau Fermi liquid. And I will briefly discuss with what Landau Fermi liquid is. What are the basic principles of Landau Fermi liquid? So key ideas of Landau Fermi liquid concept. So, idea one. So, spin charge and momenta of fermions whose better to say as follows. So spin charge and momentum of fermions in the occupied state at zero temperature, of course. The dissolves at zero temperature. Remain the same as in Fermi gas. So what does this mean? This means that if we imagine our Fermi surface, then even if particles interact, then classification of momenta at zero temperature remains the same. We still can ascribe to particles certain momenta, just here, certain charge, and certain spin. So the quantum mechanical classification of states remains the same. And as a result of this, I can write that we can say that there is one-to-one correspondence between excitations. So this just means if the ground state can be classified according spin and momentum, then excitations also, their classification also resembles the classification of excitations in Fermi gas. And what is really remarkable and can be rigorously proven is that this Fermi momentum, Kf, is not determined by interactions. It is determined solely by the number of particles, so better to say by concentrations. Kf equal to 3 pi squared n in power 1/3 and does not depend on interactions. We know that for the gas, there is Fermi momentum. So if k is smaller than kf, then all energy levels are occupied. And kf is determined by concentration. So when we turn interactions on, this relation remains the same. It can be rigorously proven using diagrammatic technique. But the proof of this statement requires knowledge that is well beyond any graduate course, I would say. And typically, so yes?
Is that at zero temperature?
Huh? At zero temperature, yes. This is just at zero temperature. When we talk about ground state and the excitations, then we imply that the temperature is zero. What is excitation? We took a particle from underneath of Fermi surface and put it here. This will be our excited states, and this difference is the energy of excitations. So what we're saying is that for interacting systems, the classification of states, excited states, remains the same. So one must make an important note here. I have still one more free board. Important note that the fundamental principle behind Landau's argument is adiabatic continuity. Yeah.
What's the ground state interacting? What's the ground state energy, sorry, the expression for the energy?
I will explain. I will explain a little bit later. So Fermi momentum, yeah, Fermi momentum is the same, but not the Fermi energy. Just give me a second. So it contains the renormalized mass, but I will go to this. The renormalized mass that we have here. So adiabatic continuity, what does this mean? So this means you probably saw in quantum mechanics one theorem. So you have a system described by Schrodinger equation, and you impose time-dependent interaction. The time-dependent weak interaction. Then if this weak interaction increases slowly, very slowly, then the system, the energy, the system remains in qualitatively the same state. Its energy may slightly change, but not the character of the wave function. So there is exponentially small probability for the system to be excited towards higher energy states if the interaction increases very slowly. So a very, very good illustration is as follows. So suppose we have just a particle moving in a box. And suppose we have a particle moving here in the parabolic potential. So what do we have? We have this energy that doesn't have any zeros. We have the energy excited state in which wave function has one zero somewhere here. And then continuing, we have the state with two zeros. So this is the lowest energy state. Then this is the excited state, first excited state. This is second excited state. So and the similar thing we have for a particle in the parabolic potential. We have the ground state. Then we have first excited state that whose wave function has one zero. And then we have the state, probably looking like this, whose wave function has two zeros. So if we change the harmonic potential in such a way that it becomes very steep or somehow deform this potential slowly, then if the particle was in the ground state here, then it will remain in the ground state here. If we do something as a perturbation starting from infinite past, and we deform parabolic potential into the well potential, then if the particle was in the ground state initially, it will remain in the ground state subsequently. So the same argument applies for the system of interacting fermions. So if we imagine that we turn interactions slowly, very slowly from minus infinity up to present moment, then the classification of states remains the same. This was Landau's argument. The question is this argument omnipotent or absolutely, or should be taken as something absolute, as an axiom? So the answer is no. No. Not only because people now observe non-Fermi liquid behavior all around, but also you will see based on your homework problem that if interaction is strong enough, then the system is unstable towards formation of ferromagnetic moment, exactly in this model. this is your homework problem. So we can expect, though, that this argument works if interaction is weak enough. But again, since we don't know how to solve exactly the many particle problem that interact with each other, there is, at this point of development of many-body theoretical physics, we can do little to prove all those things deeply enough to our satisfaction, I would say. So, but people recognize that the system in the system of liquid helium, helium-3, interactions are quite weak, and in fact, liquid helium is the only liquid where quantum effects are important. All other compounds, they solidify at quite high temperatures, and those solids may only remotely resemble what we have in liquid helium. So finally, point two about Fermi liquid is that quasi-particle, so the energy of quasi-particles close to Fermi momentum is epsilon f plus kf divided by m star k minus kf. This is the second principle. So what we see here the renormalized mass. And the renormalization is quite strong in liquid helium. So specific heat, this is the second thing. Specific heat, this was the first, this is the second. Specific heat is kf m star divided by 3 times t. So, and it contains the renormalized mass. So Fermi energy also comes with renormalized mass.
That's the energy of a quasi particle made up of k?
The epsilon of k, right. So k is this.
What is the trade area to say interaction is weak enough to use it? Like maybe there has to be some reference to say if to use greater than.
Well, this is what I don't really remember what is called here. So I don't know how you can, what are the non-thermodynamic methods, how to probe interactions between particles, so on. Unfortunately, I have to say that there are experimental definitely methods, and they develop year after year. So experiments on liquid helium were performed in 30s, 40s, and even 50s. People simply make the statement that interactions between atoms between helium atoms are quite weak, say compared to the interactions, say, between atoms of heavy gases, for example, because helium is a light gas. So why is this? Unfortunately, I don't really remember. So finally, some information about just liquid helium before I move to the next topic. So system of helium-3, So atom helium contains 2 electrons, 2 protons, and 1 neutron. So Fermi energy. Fermi energy is equal to 2.5 Kelvin, and Kf is approximately 0.8 times 10 in power 8 centimeters minus 1. So roughly speaking, 1 angstrom. The distance between atoms is roughly speaking 1 angstrom. So because angstrom is 10 in power minus 8 centimeters. So, and effective mass, that was successfully measured in experiments that calculate heat capacity. Those experiments were quite well developed, and they were developed more than a century ago. So it is 3.1 electron masses. So, and what happens with the phase diagram? Of helium-3, the phase diagram. The phase diagram is a function of pressure versus temperature. So here we have some line, and here we have another line that, so we have some kind of an increase. This is at zero pressure. So apparently experiments on liquid helium were also performed when the pressure was low. So the temperature at zero, there are two temperatures at zero pressure. One is equal to 100 millikelvins, and one is 1.1 millikelvin. So at 100 millikelvins, gas of helium becomes liquid. Here, liquid. In fact, Fermi, liquid. And here we have gas. Well, this line is dashed because the process is quite smeared. Well, quite smeared. Well, so the process of evaporation of helium. So first here in the gas, quantum effects remain a little bit more important, but when temperature is increased, so it becomes like a classical gas with absolutely non-important quantum effects. But what happens here? What happens here is extremely interesting. Superfluid. That's extremely interesting thing. This is at zero temperature, this is below 0.1 millikelvin. So Alec will tell a little bit about superfluidity, but in the system of helium-4, and this is the system of bosons, because helium system of helium-3 is the system of fermions. And how superfluidity obtains here, it's a very complicated question. I only know when I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois, this was my first year, and three people received the Nobel Prize for doing exactly experiment to study superfluid phase at extremely low temperatures. But it's just an interesting thing just to recall. Okay, I am done with Fermi liquids, and to today's our lecture is going to be quite long, because otherwise we won't move at least approximately to superconductivity. So next topic. Next topic, superconductivity. So superconductivity. So superconductivity was first observed in 1911 by Dutch physicist Kamerlingh Onnes. An interesting, I see only Tiffany, who is a student from Netherlands. So I don't see other two students. So, but I must tell you that people who are from Netherlands should be really proud of their physics school. Yes, especially of people who made enormous contribution in the 20th century. So superconductivity. superconductivity. So it was observed first. The first experiments were done with respect to mercury that resistivity abruptly drops to zero. So this is resistivity. It initially decays as it is common for metals, and then abruptly goes to zero at some critical temperature. So the first properties, so resistivity rho is zero for T minus Tc. So at the time of discovery, this was really a big puzzle. But the second property that puzzled people was discovered much later. So it is 1911. The second property that is quite interesting is the property that if you put superconductor in magnetic field, then the magnetic field does not penetrate the bulk of the superconductor. Instead, a superconductor expels magnetic field, and if for normal metal it approximately penetrates the material, so this is normal metal, then if you look at the line, and this was measured, and at the lines of magnetic field, then they look like this. They circumvent. Superconductor. They don't penetrate. They try to avoid it. Okay? They try to avoid superconductor. This superconductor. This is the so-called Meissner effect. And I believe it was first discovered in 1933. So then experimental evidence piled up, and for almost 50 years after its discovery, people were unable to explain what's going on in superconductors. The interesting thing that people observed many similarities to the behavior of superfluid phase of helium-4. And they asked questions, whether there is something going on that has some kind of a quantum state that is similar to the quantum state of bosons in helium-4. So Oleg will tell you on Monday about the phenomenon of superfluidity. We'll mention probably helium-4. So what happens there? This is the system of bosons. And bosons tend to condense in the lower state. So weak enough interactions between helium atoms in helium-4 don't preclude the formation of the condensate, if they are strong enough, then condensate is absent, of course. But for helium-4, people observed condensate, not for helium-3. But as I mentioned, it has also a superfluid phase, but there things are much more complicated. So in the system of helium-4, the phenomenon of superfluidity occurs, meaning that liquid, this quantum liquid, can flow without any viscosity. It's a non-viscous liquid. So what we have here? We have here the lack of resistivity. This means that we some kind have the liquid of electrons that travels without any resistance. So this was the similarity. And people asked the question whether some kind of condensate can be observed in superconductors. But the problem is that the system of superfluid helium is the system of bosonic particles. Helium-3 are fermionic, but helium-4 are bosonic. because they have zero spin. Electrons are fermionic, so they cannot condense. We don't have the phenomena of condensation in the system of fermions. This is a known fact. This is due to different sign in the distribution, in Bose-Einstein distribution and Fermi-Dirac distribution. So that's why people couldn't explain this phenomenon, the phenomenon of superconductivity, for so long. Yeah?
Like, why do you think PEC? Like, I mean, if they ground state and ferrous state is dead, like, that, like...
Let me just continue. Let's talk later about this. So, because... And what happens in late 50s, scientist Cooper, who received also the Nobel Prize, he put forward the idea that fermions can have paired state in such a way that paired state is a singlet. And singlet is effectively a combination that has zero spin. So those singlets can condense. Those singlets called Cooper pairs, and they can condense and thus behave as bosons and thus can carry current without resistance. So the last thing we're going to consider, and so I will need probably 50 minutes more for this, is Cooper problem. Cooper problem is formulated as follows. Let's imagine that we have a field, Fermi C field. And imagine that we have two particles of opposite moment, k and minus k. K and minus K, right? And let's assume, so their total momentum is zero, that they somehow interact with each other and their total wave function, say R1, sigma 1, comma R2, sigma 2, can be written as follows. The orbital part, psi R1 minus R2, times spin part. And spin part is in the form of a single state. And the momentum of both particles are very close to Fermi surface. So very, very close to Fermi surface. So this spin part of the wave function is anti-symmetric, so this wave function must be symmetric. And let's assume that its symmetry dictates that it can be written in this form, equal to sum over all momenta phi k, e in power I k r1 minus r2, and f of k equal to f of minus k. This is because this wave function must be symmetric with respect to R1 minus R2. So our task is to write down the Schrödinger equation and to determine the total energy of the system. To determine the total energy of the system. So we have the Schrödinger equation minus h bar squared divided by 2m, nabla 1 squared plus nabla 2 squared, psi plus some potential or R1 minus R2 psi equal to, and this is the energy. So we write the energy in the following form. So suppose these particles are very close to almost on top of Fermi energy. So their total energy is presumed to be equal to 2 epsilon f plus some correction that we need to determine. Call it A, sorry, E. What about interaction? Regarding interaction, we will assume something that will become clear when we substitute this and that into this Schrödinger equation and recast our problem. I will skip the intermediate steps that are in my notes. So substituting and that. And that for psi r1 minus r2, we get the following equation, h bar squared k squared divided by m, not to m, but m, because of two Laplace operators. F of k plus sum over k prime, here f k prime u of k minus k prime equal to e plus 2 epsilon f of k. So this procedure is done in the textbook on quantum mechanics, and it is quite standard. So we just then make the following interesting assumption that this interaction interaction is attractive and is non-zero only in the narrow region around Fermi surface, just here. U of k minus k prime not equal to zero and negative. So that interaction has this form, u over k minus k prime equal to, call it this way, g over v, where v is the volume, only when epsilon k minus f and epsilon k prime minus epsilon f are smaller than this parameter, h omega d. This is some kind of frequency that is of the order of the bifrequency. So this narrow region is exactly h omega d. This is just a model. This is an assumption. The physical reason behind this assumption is that the attraction arises as a result of interactions with phonons. So during yesterday's tutorial, there was an optional problem that allows us to see how, this is the very end of the tutorial, how this attraction is generated if you consider interactions between fermions and phonons in the path integral approach. It's a very concise and beautiful way. You just integrate out phonons and see, oh, that there is some effective attraction between electrons that is negative. Of course, it depends on momentum, but this is, of course, a very crude approximation, but this crude approximation works. It is completely clear that this scale is narrow because what is h omega d? This is the bioenergy. This is where we observe the transition from quantum mechanical behavior of phonons to classical behavior of phonons. But this parameter is just hundreds of Kelvin, while the Fermi energy in metals is 1,000 Kelvin, 5-10,000 Kelvin. So H over D over epsilon n, so is always in this case a small parameter. This is only in liquid helium, the Fermi energy is 2.5 Kelvin, but in metals, it's 1,000 Kelvin. So this was the Cooper model, and he was the first to study this simple model in order to show how electrons can form singlets that look as bosons. And when you, so I don't have time, so I'm wrapping up. So if you solve Schrodinger equation, if you make this substitution into this equation, so you should really look at my notes. At the end of my notes, I will post, because Monday's tutorial will be devoted to Cooper problem. So if you plug this ansatz, then you will have the following equation, that this function f of k, that enters wave function f of k, can be written like that, g over v times some sum, where we have sum over momenta k prime, and sum is supplemented by prime of f k prime, equal to 1 over epsilon k, and what is epsilon k is h squared right divided by 2m. One second. Is it 2m? Yeah, 2m, right. In this case, k h squared minus e minus 2ef. This prime means exactly what is given here. We sum only over those states that in the narrow region near Fermi surface. This is what this prime means. And this equation allows us to have self-consistent equation that determines the gap. That determines the gap. I will write this equation and the final result. Not the gap, but energy E that will be negative. So that's minus E will be positive, and indeed it acts as a gap. So that's why I mentioned the word gap. 1 equal to G over V sum over k prime of this prime sum, 1 over epsilon k prime minus e minus 2ef. And this is the self-consistency equation that will allow you to determine this e. So as a result, we obtain the following. For weak interaction, for the interaction that satisfies mu of epsilon times g much smaller than 1, we have e in equal to minus 2 h omega d times exponent minus 2 divided by mu of epsilon f g. So this is just the result. Calculations are quite simple, and they're in my notes. So we see that this energy is negative. So even if we have two particles that are here, lie at the Fermi surface, then attractive interaction effectively lowers the energy of the system. So it becomes more favorable for two particles to form a bound state. And this is the origin of attraction between electrons whose momenta lie very close to Fermi surface. That's all for today, my friends. I'm sorry that it took 15 minutes longer. Mm-hmm. Nu is the density of states. Nu of f is the density of states. density of states. And G is the strength of interaction that is non-zero only near ferment energy. Okay, so on Monday, Alec will take over. Yeah. Thank you very much for your attention. If you have questions, don't hesitate to ask.